So this is about the intergalactic medium. I think most of you know something about it. So this talk goes fairly deep into certain sorts of measurements, although it's not at the review level. I'm not trying to summarize all the activity. There's a lot of activity in the area where I am. So I'm mostly going to push our view of what we think we can do as opposed to what other groups are doing. So I apologize, it's not really a review talk. It wasn't written for that purpose. What we've been looking for is a concordant model for the intergalactic medium. So that means concordant in two senses. It means concordant with everything that's known about the universe and astrophysics, so particularly cosmological parameters should be reasonable, right? It shouldn't contradict anything. And secondly, we should be able to reproduce the intergalactic medium in terms of all of the data on the intergalactic medium. So it's generally inclusive, and it's precisely inclusive in our little area. And that's not been done before. And the reasons are it's kind of hard, right? It's hard from observations. If you've done in sub areas, you can pick a parameter and get the simulation to agree with that and so on. And of course, we're vastly helped by WMAP and the huge improvement in the knowledge of parameters from all over the subject in the last few years. It's now really doable. So that's the background. When we started this out, we didn't know too much about it, and we thought, well, we were sensitive to sigma 8 and baryon density and, you know, probably lambda. And if you read the literature carefully, you can actually find out exactly what you're sensitive to, but there's a lot of papers, and you don't necessarily recall all of them and so on. And as we continued, we said, well, we're also sensitive to the Hubble constant almost as much, and so on. The title actually grew, and you end up with almost all the parameters. And when you step back from it, it makes sense because the intergalactic medium's a lot of volume. It's the dark matter. It's the baryons. They respond to each other. It's a good way of sensing almost everything, right? There are a few things that wouldn't be relevant here, but there are not that many. So that's the kind of summary of it. I wanted to describe the author a little bit. This is a merge of two groups in San Diego, Mike Norman's and my one. We're observers. We use Keck and Hubble and so on. And Mike Norman's used supercomputers doing simulations. We're actually in the same corner of the same floor, so we interact a lot. And we kind of merge activities in a lot of these things. And two of these people, Suzuki, who's in my group, an observer, and Yena are both looking for postdoc positions, if anybody's looking for anybody in this area. So I'm going to begin with some data, and I end up in the simulation end. And it kind of starts easy, but it tries to give us a fairly firm foundation for things. So this is a quasar spectra. I'll talk about this a fair bit. This is one of the two bits we contributed to, and the other bit is parameters in the simulations. Who could not describe this to me? How long should I spend on this? Everybody know exactly what this is? So the flux really does go up and down like this, right? These are the emission lines of the gas near the quasar. Despite 30 years of work, we have no way to predict these, right? And even given a part of it, it's extremely hard to predict another part, right? Because the gas is coming from a variety of places, it's moving, there's obscuration, depends on angle, they're all different and so on, right? So these bumps are real. And they continue over to here, but they're harder to see, right? these little bumps here. There's a general underlying level coming from an accretion disk, and that's fine and easy, and you can roughly see what that is. I'm interested in how much absorption here, because most of this absorption, but not all of it, comes from the intergalactic medium. So it's a neutral hydrogen. This is Lyman alpha absorption. It's fluctuating because the density fluctuates in the intergalactic medium from the primordial perturbations that have grown over time, right? So it's imprinting that. And the question I'll show you the answer to is how much absorption is there on average in this region of the spectrum? And this is about 400 megaparsecs in co-moving distance, something like that. So that's a...
I mean, what we don't understand there is how you understood where to draw the continuum.
There? No, I'll show you what I did. Okay. Yeah, that is actually you're right on track. That's where we're going. So the tiny bit of history, my student who loves history was upset I didn't have a history slide on this, so there you go, right? There's a lot of papers, and I read them all long ago, and I've actually forgotten most of them, even though they're very good. The amount of absorption in in lines, when you look at a spectra like that, you saw it looked like spectral lines, and the subject started in that direction, and it went down that for about 25 years, and then we later realized that was a bad idea because it's a continuous medium, and we should actually have been thinking in terms of fields and continuous variables and so on. It's a lot easier that way. So all the early literature talks about Lyman alpha lines, and it's hard to decode that in modern terms, but I will use both a little bit here. The amount of absorption on average, the first paper that I recall is Gunn and Peterson, and they're pointing out that even a tiny amount of neutral hydrogen in the intergalactic medium causes a lot of absorption, because the Hubble expansion is not that much, so as photons redshift through the wavelength where they can be absorbed, 12, 16 angstroms, they get to go a few megaparsecs, and that's a long way, right? Even very, very, very low density, right? So very, very sensitive to the amount of neutral hydrogen. The most interesting early measurement is by Bevoak and Koyakansky, 1982, a very important paper, and that was the foundation for a lot of what I'm doing here in terms of the thinking. There have been measurements continuously since then. There's another 10 or 12 papers, and these are some of the more recent ones, and including Bernardi. If you had to use some of these, the Rauch is a very careful one, but the sample's too small. These are high-res spectra, very good spectra. It's just too small sample. Shire's probably the best of the high-resolution ones. That's fine as far as I can tell. And Bernardi has a systematic error, which almost everybody in the field is believing is the case, because it differs from everybody else. So that's the background. So the main problem is that, right? So where is the continuum? And what that means is, what would the spectrum have looked like if I were near enough to the quasar that wasn't any absorption from the intergalactic medium? There is, of course, no statistical answer to a question like that, right? That is not a well-posed question. It's a what if, but you can't change history. So you're just going to have to guess it, and I show you how we go about guessing it. The commonest guess is a power law in quotes, because it's very clear from the data that the thing bends. It's not a straight line, right? And the amount of bending will depend on temperature of the quasar. So we go to quasars at low redshift because they show very little absorption, right? And so you're basically seeing what you want. And it's known that they're not vastly different from high redshift ones. They are different, but it's not the main point. This is real data, experimental data out of Hubble. The mean ultraviolet spectrum of a bunch of quasars, and there's about 50 objects there. You might notice later on, the emission line here, the Lyman alpha, is very strong in low redshift objects because the volume of the universe at low redshift is small. You don't get the superluminous quasars that you have at higher redshift. And there's something called the Baldwin effect, which means that these tend to be stronger in those objects, right? So that's a known issue. You can find objects like this at HISI, but they're not the ones I'm looking at. So I get rid of that, and we're looking at this bit here. So this is zero flux. This is an average spectrum. There are clearly emission lines here and here. A common practice to put a straight line on here, and that's known to be biased by comparing different samples. But the bias will depend on where you decide to anchor the line, right? And these emission lines blend together anyway, so it's just going to be a personal choice, basically. It's not a bad thing to do. It's just, as the accuracy goes up, you want to do better. The quasars differ. If you group them by some of the emission line properties, you can emphasize some of the differences. This is a little bit small, isn't it? Okay, these guys don't have a very strong Lyman alpha. They look actually more like the high redshift quasars on average that I look at, which are very luminous, and so that ratio is kind of typical. These lines are getting to be quite important at a few percent level, and if you don't know over there, you'll go right through them, and you'll either go too high or too low, or whatever. And I can find another set where there's basically nothing going on in there, something like that. So. So that's the observational background to it. That's, I think, largely known in the subject, but not known in the literature for the measurement of the mean amount of absorption as well as it should have been, right? I mean, it's in the most recent papers, but not in the older ones, for instance. So this is what we got. We're using 77 quasar spectra. We've got quite a lot more now. We're keeping on doing this because this is working very well. The average redshift is 2.2, mean absorption is 1.9. That's very low, it's deliberately low. We didn't want to tangle with Sloan, see why we want to do that. Big teams, tons of data, quite clear where to go. We're a different redshift from them. We're at a lower redshift from them, deliberately using different methods, and we just slightly overlap. So we can actually see if we get the same answers in various things. That was done deliberately. Also, the intergalactic medium gets easier at lower redshift. There's fewer absorption lines, more likely to get continuum right, stuff like that. Right? A lot of things get better. The history of the heating is less important, long ago in most cases. It turned out to be a very good choice. The resolution's 250, a bit worse than Sloan, yeah, a little bit worse. Total path length, if you add up the redshift ranges, is 19.8. That's a typical moderate sample and quasar sort of work, so it's plenty big. This is done on a 3-meter telescope, and we're very proud of that. It's an old telescope, and it's almost as old as I am. And yeah, it's got a good instrument, and it can do very good stuff still, if you know what you're doing with it. Total number of photons we've got is not dissimilar to Sloan. It's actually kind of similar for quasars. Their average signal to noise is 1 or 2, and ours is 10, 20, something like that. So we're going to get a different sort of bias and result and stuff like that. And then, now, these are some of the spectra. I'm going to show you a few of them because you can see by eye what the issues are going to be when I try to make a measurement of the mean, right? You'll be able to see those. Do you notice something different from these in the first spectra I showed you? Put it back up. It's obviously a slightly different scale. But anybody see anything different? Where? Yeah. You mean, well, where should I move? Here?
Yeah.
These guys? Can you give me more clues? What did you see that's different?
Absorption on the right side, I think that's what you see.
Yeah, this bit?
Yeah.
What is different now? I mean, yeah, they're different from each other, of course, because they're different quasars. This is an artificial spectra that we made. And these are real ones.
Well, there's much stronger absorption lines in the real one. The one you made.
Yep, that's true. Some of them, yeah, that's right. Some of them are. Yep, that's correct. That's right. Yep. That sort of blending thing, there's some clumping that we haven't correctly simulated in the algorithm there. There's a few differences. But notice this one also has almost no metal absorption on the red side, as does this one. We didn't try to put it in there. But they're quite good. I was just trying to make a point that the artificial ones we'll be using are actually quite good. So there's some real ones. Let's look at a few more. These sort of plots, the way it looks is extremely sensitive to the stretch, right? And I can stretch it to show a point, right? And these haven't been stretched to make them look either similar or different, just to fit in the page. So some of the differences here are just due to the way the emission lines expand and contract the scale. But if I move on a bit further, you'll see some things that are... So you can see some stronger emission lines and some weaker ones. That lot. I wanted to get to a certain set. These all could look the same. Okay, this one I marked. No, these are all real. The very first one was a simulation. Sorry?
It's a hyper simulation or is it just...
No, it's a toy one. Yeah, it's a... has the property I want, meaning it looks like a spectrum, but its origin is unrelated to the universe or anything else, right? Okay, there's these things. There's several of them. I didn't stop on all of them. These are called damp Lyman alphas, so they're coming from regions around galaxies that have a lot of neutral hydrogen. They have a noticeable effect in the power spectrum because they extend way out here to kind of dip the thing down. They come with a ton of metals, too, which are actually all over the place. You can't easily see them on there. We'll talk about those a little later. And there are There are other ones. This, I thought, was one of the better examples of it. There are clearly significant regions where there is a lot less absorption. This has been known for 30 years, and it used to bother us a lot. We used to think a lot of this stuff was ejected from the quasar because we just did not like that amount of variation. During the talk, I'll show you we can account for that in the degrees of modern clustering, and it's coming from scales of the order of 100 megaparsecs or something like that. Large scale stuff can be seen in these data sets in the variety, which an observer could see at the telescope just by comparing spectra. Right? But, we were able to quantify that. So that's enough of the data. The summary of them, that's the redshifts I'm going to talk about. The quasar emission redshifts, the absorption you talk about is always less than that. So I'll just go to that one. So we got data down to 1.6, but I'm mostly talking about 1.9. I'm typically going to collapse our results back to 1.9. I'm not interested in this range. It's not very wide. There's a little bit of evolution, but not a lot. I'm not interested. I'm going to get rid of it, right? And so I mostly won't talk about the range. And the Sloan stuff begins around 2.2 and goes on up to 4, something like that, because of their spectrograph wavelength range. That's right, with the high resolution data. That's exactly right. Yeah. There's at least 7 that overlap exactly at R. Correct. So how we dealt with the continuum. So we made artificial spectra. There are 2 ways of fitting continua. I showed you one just now, which is to extrapolate, you know, draw a line and just see what happens, basically. It's quick, easily automated, stuff like that, but it's not considered adequate for what we're trying to do today. We want better, higher precision. So the other way is to go into the spectra one by one and do something, right? And what you do is actually kind of tricky, be it algorithm or human or whatever. So we made one artificial spectra for each real one because we're going to do it manually. We're not going to rely on an algorithm. The decision was made as follows, which may surprise you in a day of computers. It's quicker to do it manually than it is to think of, test, and validate an algorithm which would do as well as a human. The reason is it's an AI problem. It's an artificial intelligence problem. It's a mighty tricky little problem. It's a completely biased problem to get the continuum right automatically and so on. And we've tried it, and we've given up on that approach. It would take months, and this takes weeks. So that's the decision we made. And we're happy with that decision because I can show you it was good enough. So it's a little strange, right? And we're actually a precision group, so we like algorithms. It's just we didn't like this particular algorithm. It's very, very hard. So the artificial spectra matched an emission redshift, so that they're going to have the same range of wavelengths. We made the resolutions the same, the signal to noise the same. We started with real Hubble Space Telescope quasars, right? And we added artificial absorption, which is pretty close, except for the very strong lines. So here's the starting point. These are real Hubble spectra. There are only 50 quasars for which Hubble has high enough signal to noise to do this. And now the spectrograph's broken, so that's it. I mean, it's not going to happen again. They've been fitted to remove the absorption lines. There are several lines, particularly from the galaxy here. They've gone. And we kind of fitted a smooth continuum through it, knowing the best we do about quasars, right? But these are believed to be pretty representative of what you would have seen at high redshift. They're just representative. We don't care exactly what they are. Here are the artificial absorbers made by Pat McDonald. He kindly gave us these. These are the same things he's been using in the Sloan analysis data, so they're actually pretty good. They're good in many, many, many senses, except they don't have the very high columns, correct? They're not physically motivated. They're just coming out of an exponential equation that happens to do about the right thing. So you can't change the sigma rate in these. There isn't one, right? They're just fake parameters that look like real spectra. They have power spectra and mean flux, which are extremely close to the real data, right? They're close to the Sloan data, and they're close to our data. So they're very good, but they're just toy things that we use. So we multiply those together and we get that. And then we add photon noise and we get that. Right? And very noisy and not so noisy and so on. So the advantage of these, there's a few more, is that we can make the bottom plot. Having drawn a continuum on these, which we did by looking at plots not dissimilar to this, but magnified to emphasize the things we wanted. And having learnt about the emission lines, it took a little while. There wasn't much in the literature on that. There was Bernardi paper, and I mean, once you find them, you can go back and find a trail, but they were just tiny little blips and little figures with no comments and stuff. And once we found those emission lines, then we were able to fit these continua level, but we also knew the true one, right? Because these are artificial spectra, we can ratio the two, and hopefully it'll work pretty well. It's not quite blind because the red side lacks lines and so on, right? But later on, it's like a video game. So you put the spectra up, right, and you put points down on it, and it draws a smooth curve through it, which happened to be a B spline, which you just use for recording what you did, right? And you can move the points around, you can adjust it very quickly. So it just keeps the curve basically, but you can manually move it, right? You can make it as bumpy or as smooth as you want, but it doesn't conform to any particular simple algorithm because of course the emission lines don't either, you know. I mean, they vary a lot in width and height and shape and asymmetry and so on. So that's a real hard route to go that way. So you know the true continua and you fitted one on it, but you don't look at this bottom plot until you're really, really bored. Right? So you keep doing it. You do it, and then you sort them by signal to noise, and you go through the stack, and then you sort them by emission lines, and you go through the stack, and each sort takes a day or so, something like that. It's pretty quick. And then at the end, when you think you couldn't do any better, and you've done the same thing to the data, which you kind of mixed in with the artificial, then you look at the true one, and you can see what your biases were, right? And we thought the result was fine, so we stopped. We didn't iterate through the whole thing. A single go through it worked fine. I won't stop on that one, but I'll show you this one. So this is a common sort of error. We're doing fine in this region, where we're off by a few percent. The mean error we've got is actually about 3%, which isn't bad. If we're going to have 77 objects and you're going to get a square root n advantage, that's going to be great, right? But we often miss this little dip between the two emission lines, and that's related to signal to noise and stuff like that. So there we were too high by 12% or something like that. There's another example of the same thing. Generally doing quite well. We were surprised by that. It's relatively quick.
It's actually connected with the flux there. How far off you're from the continuum depends on whether you get
wider. Which one do you want to see? That one?
Well, there you were off because there was a strong line.
Where are you looking at it? Here?
Where your arrow is.
We did look for that explicitly. And although it might look like that here, we didn't actually find that was the underlying reason. And the reason is the person doing it's smart. They know about damps. They know about Lyman alphas. They know about clustering. And they accommodate for it. And they actually get it about right.
For example, when you say the true continuum is like we get that within 3%.
Yep.
But then the cases where is it true that the cases where you're wrong is by 10%?
Yep. Yeah.
Because they're always low.
No, not particularly. I'll show you that in a second. It might have been. It might have been, but it turned out not to be. But this is the strongest bias, which isn't that one. It's another one. When the signal to noise was low, we tended to go high. Right? And I don't know where stopping at. And the errors are kind of hard to see by eye, so you'd probably never fix it. That's just, you know. I mean, if you tried to go back and fix this, you'd probably overdo it. Right? So, the typical error in that, those are extreme ones, was about 0.16 sigma per pixel, and you can't see that by eye, and you don't integrate it very well, and stuff like that. Here's a summary of it, the whole thing. So we're almost at the end of this bit. So there's mean error in the continuum for 77 quasars. I've now thrown away which quasar it came from, and I've just binned it up by signal to noise, ignoring absorption lines. Just how good is the data in that region of the spectrum, right, is what that is. And on average, we're about 1% too low. So that's quite good, right? And I know what it is, because this is a calibration measurement. And there's the problem at low signal to noise going up like that. So I just removed this. I said, OK, so these continue are too low by 1%. We just take them all up, right? And that was done, you know, one go and so on. So. And here's what you were asking.
So did you remove the low signal-to-noise spectrum?
Or yeah. The very lowest signal-to-noise were at the lowest wavelengths, and they got chopped off. Right? Actually, not by signals and noise, we actually chop them by wavelength. We just say we're not going to go that far and down the end of the spectrum. They're not a large number of total pixels. I won't try to illustrate that. All right, the horizontal axis is the amount of absorption in a 25 angstrom region. So this is there a lot of absorption or not? And this is artificial spectra, so we know that exactly. And this is the error, so that's zero error, that's minus 2%, and that's plus 2%. So we didn't do very bad. And these are the means kind of for the whole data set. And we just corrected by that curve. Yeah, so it's the most 1%. It could have been much bigger. I fully agree. I think the reason we didn't fall into this trap, as it says, because the person doing it knew what was happening. And they attempted to they fit lines for many years and they know what's going on. This is the one sigma standard deviation in the values in each pixel. But there's a lot of pixels, so the mean is much better known. So that makes sense. We're carrying extra information because we use it for other reasons.
You're not having metal lines in your simulated spectra, do you?
Correct. No, we do not. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So we had to make a choice, and the choice was to measure from rest wavelengths 1070 to 1170. This avoids that region where I commonly had a problem between the emitter. I just said, forget it, I'll never get that right. So I just chopped that off. So we only actually use about half of what we might have used. We use the middle half. This shows what happened in the artificial spectra. This is the metal line region up to here on the red here. You can see we got a slight bias. You know, we don't get to continue exactly right. And then this looks fine. It's getting worse at low signal to noise, what you see there. I'm just going to replot the same thing. Here it is as a standard deviation. So what is the standard deviation of a ratio of of fitted to true? So it's kind of your error, basically, right? And you're around 3.5% or so. This is a Lyman alpha emission line. We're doing worse than the wings of that, as you'd guess, because it's got some gradient. You don't know what it is. And the thing's accelerating going up. It's a logarithmic shape, and it's kind of hard to guess it. And low signal to noise in that extra emission line, right? So that's why we're sitting in that region. This is actually a narrow region compared to previous papers. They tend to go a little wider, a little bit, not a lot. So now I'm going to make the measurement. There are three definitions around in the literature, and this is the commonest one, mean flux, F bar, observed, divided by true, continuum, something like that, right? For our data, this will be a value of, say, about 0.85, something like that. Not much absorption. Because it's almost one, changes in it don't make a large relative effect. If that kind of thing, say 0.85 and 0.86 are kind of similar. But if you subtract one from it, relative changes are easier to plot and easier to see, and just life goes quicker. Right? So that's why I work with this. One minus that DA. And this actually goes back to Oak's paper from 1982, where he used similar notation. So this is continuum minus observed upon continuum. So if this has a value of 5%, it means 5% absorption. That's all. Right? And sometimes you use the effective optical depth expressed like that. Down. You'll see all three in the literature.
But your continuum fitting, I didn't see a constraint that would demand that your DA quantity doesn't go negative.
Sure. No, could.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't care. Yeah, I work entirely in DA.
I understand. Right. Continuum fitting you had no constraint that the data has to go below the continuum, did you?
Let's look at let's make sure we're talking about the same thing. So I'll put a spectrum out. Okay. So because the data has noise, it can of course be on either side, right? But were it noise free, I can't have a continuum below what is definitely the level of the data, because that's unphysical. Yeah. So there is that constraint, but that's simply a make sure you didn't make that error, basically. It's fairly easy to do that. It's not enough to drive an algorithm. I mean, if that kind of makes sense.
In the end, you would probably show it. In the end, you would eventually start seeing the root end of your data, right? I mean, after you fit up the lines with the continuum, the scatter should be consistent with the photon counting noise or your
plus, right? Mm-hmm, that's right. Yep, the photons...
That's a constraint on your whole model of man.
The photons end up not being the biggest factor. And there are other more interesting things, actually, as we get near the end. Okay, so here's a DA plot, and you'll see a few others similar to this. So vertical is amount of absorption. Here's zero. These are now corrected data. So I've removed what was my common problem in fitting the continuum, right? So this should be true, right? This should be a good measurement. This is rest wavelength. So there's the Lyman alpha emission line. The absorption comes on gradually because of proximity effect and errors in the emission redshift. You don't get it exactly right. The mean of metal absorption is about 2%. Nothing amazing going on there, right? This is a standard deviation in each pixel value. Each one's about 1 megaparsec long, so you can see there's quite a range. And this is the photon noise continuum level error when they go negative down there. So that's that bit there. Much more variation here, clearly. You start with this variation, and then you add extra variation from the Lyman alpha lines, right, in this region here. And we're going to work in this bit. We ignore that for reasons I showed you previously. Standard deviation gets bigger there. And we ignore this. The signal's always getting worse, and the Lyman betas start coming in down here and stuff like that. So this looks like we might be able to do the job, right, to make an accurate measurement. This is the red shift trend, which I'm not interested in. It's exactly the same data. I just re-bin it onto red shift now. I fit a line to it. I get the slope of a line, which is nothing surprising. And for most of what I do, I move points to make this flat. Okay? I just move them up at this end and move them down at this end, and I just throw that away. Because we don't have a big baseline. We have bias with signal to noise, which is always worse at this end, and so on, right? I don't want to go down that route of trying to do the evolution. This is getting more interesting. Same data, rebin it so that the bins are 112 angstroms wide. If the absorption is Lyman alpha, that is a change in redshift of 0.1. And at this redshift, this is 160 megaparsecs. So each of these points is 160 megaparsecs, right? The data's actually double sampled for just reasons of making the display a little easier to see. So you bin it up like this, and then you shift the bins by half a bin, right? So the faint points are the half-shifted ones, which shows a little. It shows this end better because we start at this end and we throw away anything that doesn't fill a bin. So if you shift it half, you get more points at this end like that. So there's the red shift trend that you just saw. There's quite a lot of dispersion, right, from down here all the way up here, right? And it's photon noise adds to dispersion, so the dispersion could be less than this, but it turns out photon noise isn't that significant on here. Depending on the signal to noise, it's typically about 1%, so it's about the width of my ruler, this pointer. There are 2 or 3 points per quasar as you go along the spectrum. The mean's about 15%, so that'll be that there. Standard deviation's about 6%. That's kind of this. There are some high points, but those are easy. Those are damp Lyman alphas that we saw earlier on. So now I'm going to analyze this and explain to you that we can understand the standard deviation of this and subtract off metals and things like that. Because this is kind of raw. It's not much use like that. So these are the metal lines. About half of the metal absorption is carbon-4. We measure 45% because we got spectra, so we can actually see that. We did exactly the same thing. So these points are the same as the previous ones. They're just plotted a little bit smaller, 112 angstrom bins. Sometimes there's no absorption. There are continuum level errors, so you go negative a little bit. And there's a long tail up this way, as I've drawn this little histogram, right? Very asymmetric. The variance is quite a bit bigger than the square of the mean in this case. And there it is plotted with red shift. Not a lot happening. The green line is no absorption, right? And the Lyman alpha emission line is over here somewhere. And I want a measurement over here, right? I have to extrapolate it quite a bit, actually. Fitting this in various ways with rest wavelength and against observed wavelength, which will pick out different trends and so on, and using two different data sets, it increases slightly as you go down. It's not a huge effect. And this table is real small, but it shows you roughly what happened. We measured the mean absorption to be 1.6%. So of the photons in the red wavelengths, 1.6 went to metal ions like carbon-4, magnesium-2, silicon, stuff like that. In an old published data set by Sargent, Boxenberg, and Steidel, their data set, which has some overlap with ours, got the same number. So we think that's probably about right. We're using different methods. They identified lines, and we just hit continue and subtracted the two, right? We get the same, which means most lines are strong, right? Is what that means. They're not weak little things. And from all of this, and making a slight boost because I'm extrapolating and extra lines come in that I wouldn't otherwise seen, so I'm guessing that's what the metals are doing, 2.3 plus or minus 0.5. You'll need high-resolution spectra to confirm or deny that, and it'll be very hard because you're looking for metals in the forest, and it's not easy to get all of them. You get half of them quickly, and the other half are very, very hard to get. So that number is going to be subtracted from the total absorption because it's very hard to simulate it. It's kind of a nuisance number from our point of view. So now a bit of the simulation stuff. This is a large box that Mike Norman ran. So this is a 1024 cube. You're seeing the baryons here. And for a normal Hubble constant, this is 76.8 megaparsecs across. We wanted it fairly big because the width of this is half of one of the points I was showing you, right? This is delta z 0.05. So in order to simulate one of the little points in the LA graphs, I have to go through the box twice. You know, I go through it and then go out one side and come back in and loop around, right? Almost all cosmology simulations for this subject are quite a bit smaller. And if you go into the literature, they're going to be 10 times smaller often, right? Something like that. This was quite expensive to do this. There are not many of these in the literature. Fortunately, we ran it with the correct parameters. We'd spent a while, a couple of theses are in this subject area. We've got about 30 simulations and smaller boxes and so on, and we got that. You have to pick a date. You say, okay, it's going, you know, whether or not it's right. And it was luckily very close to the real data, as I'll show as I go on. These are the simulations we ran. I'm labeling them A for the one you just saw, B, which is twice the resolution, which you need to get line widths correct to get temperature and so on, and C, D, and E are to use to show sensitivity to temperature. So they're just backup, and there are many others which I don't discuss. The parameters you need to get, and you need to get them right in order to reproduce the forest, the baryon density, and we're using a WMAP value there. The matter density, we're using 0.27. The vacuum, we're using 0.73, so just assuming flat. We're sensitive to all of these things. Hubble constant, we use 71. The sigma rate, we use 0.9. We're sensitive to that, meaning if that were not 0.9, we'd know it, if we knew all the other things. The H1 ionization rate. So this actually comes from Piero. It's the calculate what, this is in your units, right? So I've introduced this number, which is like a little h, right? It's if this gamma 912 is the wavelength of the Lyman limit. So if a photon has a shorter wavelength than that, it has enough energy to ionize neutral hydrogen, and then that atom will not absorb, so we won't see it. So we really need to know how many photons we have at those energies. This value 1 means that we're using exactly the spectrum that you published, I forget, 3-4 years ago, something like that. Right? And we actually find that's very good.
So this is J21 now.
Excuse me?
Is it J21 or gamma 12?
No, this is gamma. So this is the,
okay.
Ionization rate per hydrogen atom. That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. If the spectrum is correct, then it's proportional to the J at that time. The J is a flux of photons, and This thing here, helium-2 ionization rate, a little gamma, 228, exactly the same idea. This is artificial, right? And there's no astrophysical content in this. And the reason is we have optically thin simulations. The photons just pass right through them. Every part of the simulation gets exactly the same photon intensity. And that's not the real universe, where there are regions that are optically dense and so on, which absorb more. We need to boost the amount of photons that could ionize helium in order to get the gas hot enough to look like the spectra. Right? And everybody has to do this if they have an optically thin simulation. Almost everybody does. The optically fixed simulations of that size, nobody can run. They don't exist. There are toy ones, right? And there are attempts to do them, but they're exceedingly expensive. So they're a little bit in the future doing that. I mean, it's obviously a frontier. A lot of people are very interested in that. So this is a faked number. If we put 1.8 in here, and in this simulation, the lines look exactly like the real spectra, which means that we may have about the right temperature and so on. Right? If we do not put that in, it doesn't look right. There's no point in continuing. Right? So this is actually a topic for the future. So our resolution, which is actually one of the key numbers, is 75 kiloparsecs in the big thing, which is not good enough to get the lines right, and 37 in the smaller box, which is about the minimum to get the lines about right and so on. So it's not bad.
So I guess there's actually no prediction of when realization happens in your fits. Your fits stop somewhere, and that's where the universe realizes it's in this dimension. So I guess in your case, it must be Richard 6 or so.
Don't even know that. Yeah, don't even know. Yeah, we're down at 2.
Well, for the temperature, you do care.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm asking.
Sure.
Well, early.
That's why they normalize medium flux to reproduce the temperature.
Okay.
They change the gamma at 228
at all regions
to get the temperature right.
That's correct. That's right. Yep. Yep.
Is this fixed resolution or is there any kind of adaptive?
No, adaptive stuffs are. It seems not to help much in these cases. So here's the line width parameter distribution. So I'm going to show these compared to data in a second, but look at the units. B is the width of an absorption line. If you've gone through the spectra and fitted a lot of, they're almost Gaussians, right? They're Voigt profiles to lines. And it's not a great thing to do, but there's a history of it, right? So you can talk to each other. So lines are typically, about an angstrom wide or something like that. So this is telling you. And vertically is the number of lines of that width. So it's the frequency distribution. This is the one with a little bit of helium heating, and the red one has more helium heating, and the lines get wider as you'd expect, and so on. Right now. Of course, Tom has a paper talking about that, and it's not always easy to see these sort of effects. So from that, we could...
20 doesn't seem very far from your cell size. How much is the cell size?
Which one? 37.5, 37.7 kiloparsecs co-moving. Similar to the literature, right? So anyway, this is what we got from that, which was that the amount of helium heating that we were using in the big box and in the simulation B produced a very good fit to the data published by Kim et al. VLT spectra, which you already mentioned. And that's the best sample at these regions, easily the best sample. There's 286 lines there. They're high signal to noise spectra. They're way better than we've got from Keck. And by some miracle, they agreed, right? There isn't a graph better than this in the literature in terms of agreement. And it's something of an accident because different codes are being used, and there's a bunch of reasons why they could have been different, right? But they're not. So we set, and knowing that, we concentrate in the peaks, but the peaks obviously agree. And this is much less sensitive to what you might be doing to the thing. So
you made them agree by renormalizing the flux at 228.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I changed the spectrum.
You're saying it's surprising that the distribution.
Yeah, there's nothing this good in literature. That could have been way worse, and we still would have been happy, right? So. And then some comment on the temperature. Having done that, right, and so we got a model that has normal cosmological parameters. It seems to have the heating not too wrong at that redshift, right? Whatever happened early on has ended up being about right. We give you this, which we don't need, but communicates to the community what the simulation would look like inside it. So this is a baryon overdensity. So one's the mean density of the universe. Most of our absorption's down this region. There's a tenth of mean density. And you can read off the temperature of each of the cells in there. And we fit a line to it. And the line actually needs a bit of a break on it. I can't show that on here, can I? Not easily. Anyway, so around about there. So obviously the mean is not very well defined in a distribution like this, because there's points way up here somewhere. It's relatively cool compared to the literature, but hotter than some papers. Like there's a Dave paper that's quite a bit cooler than this at these sort of redshifts. No great surprise. There it is at redshift 2. The Hui and Hyman paper would just come out about the time I was doing this, and they changed parameters to make things that were realistic deliberately, and we think they did a very good job. Those are very similar sorts of numbers. They were simulating double reionization histories and stuff like that. It's a relatively low number. So now I'll move on to the variation, the thing. This shows a window function. The view graph's a little crude because it does the job for the message. So this is wave number for a power spectra. So this is small, as in one absorption line, megaparsecs around here somewhere. And this is around 150 megaparsecs over here. So it's big on a log scale. And vertically is how much of the power is going to remain when you filter it through a box. Now, the box I want is my points, right? The point one in delta z. So if I measure the variation in the amount of absorption in pieces of spectra, each of which is 156 megaparsecs long, where does the variation come from? Some of it comes from huge waves that just bring a whole bunch of boxes up, right? And that's over here. There's a null, and then some of it comes from smaller waves, but it's diluted because you have many modes in the box, and it kind of washes it out. So you're sensitive to large-ish scales. And this compares it with published data, so you can see what we're talking about. Very good. So that's the same horizontal scale. If you have a sine wave, and the sine wave shows up in your power spectra, then the wavelength of the sine wave would be 62 kilometers per second here, and 600, and 6,000, and so on over here. Right? So for instance, Sloan are working in, I think it's that region, I'm a little close to it to get it right. And with high resolution spectra, we often work over a kind of here somewhere. It gets a little difficult over here because of temperature, sometimes signals and noise, stuff like that. So we're usually working in this sort of region. These are some published data. Kim et al., these little pluses, and McDonald, crosses, these things, and Croft et al. Of the stars. These are actually our high-res data down here. They have lower signal to noise, so they kind of bend up. They don't have a much.
How does error in the continuum propagate to the star?
That's complicated. We haven't actually done that. We haven't gone there's a fork in the road here, and we didn't go down that one. All right? We can do so because we've got the errors in the continuum. We haven't done it. They're on a variety of scales. When you take the power spectrum of them, there's actually a whole range of scales in which the error shows up. And the size of it's not the dominant factor here. And why is that? The reason is we've got fairly high signal to noise and fairly long chunks and many chunks and stuff like that. So I'll show you a little more on that. I'm partially going down there, but I'm not going to go down the route you're going, which is to get the power spectrum of our data, right? We've not done that. These are other people's data. I'm simply going to talk about why does the amount of absorption vary from quasar to quasar, and what does that mean, right? So it's a slightly different, it's not exactly that point. So the summary of that is saying we're on much bigger scales, that's all. So this is what the mean amount of absorption does, and I showed you the data that did 2 out of 3. This bit here is the Lyman alpha from the lower density intergalactic medium, which is about 78% of the absorption at redshift 1.9. And I get that by taking the total absorption and subtracting off the metals, which I measured and extrapolated, and they're about 15% of the total. And the Lyman alphas and strong absorbers, which are about 7%. Not as well known, because the big damps are very rare, but they're huge. And that whole thing is a little divergent down, and so that number's not too well known, but it seems to be smallish. Compare that with this, which is the variance. Now, I have to specify variance in what, right? If I specify the variance in 1 pixel, it would be a different graph. This is the variance in the 150 megaparsec sections along the sight line. So, you know, about a third of the spectrum, something like that. So about equal. And this kind of surprised us. We're still not absolutely certain this is true, but it would take high-resolution data to check this. Given that, but just by central limit theorem, I can say take the variance of the whole data, and I know the variance of the whole on the red side one by one, and this I can easily calculate because I know what the equivalent widths are. So I know the distribution of this, and the total. And from central limit theorem, if you add up three numbers and you know their standard deviations, the sum of the three is just the sum of the squares and square root. It's all you got to do, nothing else, right? So I can take the square of the variance of the whole thing, the square of the variance of this, and the square of that, and subtract them, and I get that. Right? And that's how I do it, right? You can check that on a computer if you don't believe the central limit theorem, which I did. I didn't believe it. I checked it because, like everybody else, I hadn't actually seen the formal definition of it for about 10 years. And I'd forgotten it applied in this case. And I just couldn't believe it was going to work with distributions that are so asymmetric. Right? I had this Gaussian thing on my brain, right? And of course, it's got nothing to do with a distribution shape. It could be any shape you want.
Just assume that they're uncorrelated with each other.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, sure. That's right. Uh-huh. Anyway, so that's where this number comes from, right? So surprising that you could do that, but it's probably about right. So this is now the variation in the intergalactic medium, and that's coming from large-scale structure. There isn't much variation in the ionization rate at that epoch. And there's a couple more numbers on here. The top numbers you just saw, I can leave them up, I guess. I want to show you the bottom ones. So that's the number I just showed you. That was the third part of the pi that I got by subtraction. This is what you calculate taking the standard matter power spectrum, take a slope of 0.95 for the n, and go to McDonald's paper from a year and a half ago that allows you to convert from matter to flux power. Right, and then integrate the flux power across the window function I showed you. Right? Just calculate the thing out, and that's what you get. This apparently hasn't been done before, and we had to do it a few times. We're not absolutely certain we got that right either, but we stopped because it agrees. we were a little surprised by that. There's a lot of hiddenness. I mean, McDonald's stuff hasn't been checked at all. I don't think his numbers are that accurate. And I don't know what the error is on that number. That's what I'm trying to say. And down the bottom is what came out of the big box simulation that I showed you. All right, the three numbers seem to agree. So it looks like we might have an understanding of that variation. This is a distribution function for the amount of absorption in the data. So this is frequency vertically. This is zero absorption, 10%, 15, 20, 25, and so on. But we can't subtract the metals over damp Lyman alphas because these are low resolution data and we can't find them one by one. Right? We can take them off on the mean, which would just move the whole thing down, but we can't take them, right? So they're in there. And this is the simulation. and I'll just displace it, which does not have the metals and the damps. But as I just showed you, the standard deviations seem to be fine. You have to collapse this down and move it, and so on. Of course, the simulation doesn't have power on scales bigger than half a box size, so it's missing various things out there. And the toy spectra we used are actually very similar. So when we did the calibration right at the beginning, that seemed to work. All right, get near the end. So let's now go off into parameter degeneracies, of which there's lots. So I just show one of them here. So vertically is the rate of ionizing per hydrogen atom per second, etc. Right? And a one is a Hart-Madow value. And this horizontal is sigma 8, and that's a measure of the amplitude of the power spectrum. Right? And we're just using n equals 1 in this case. We don't get into what n does to this. So this band shows models that have the correct amount of absorption. Not enough absorption, too much absorption. Right? And you can see from the graph we're fairly sensitive. This graph's done by putting models in various places in many other dimensions, and this is our best guess at the moment as to what it's good around here, and it's useless there because that's not our universe, and we didn't worry about that bit. But it shows the trend as you go there. And what have I got? Yeah, two more, and that's it. So the mean amount of absorption and the standard deviation is sensitive to the cosmological parameters and the astrophysical ones. And this little table is also a little small. It gives you some idea as to what the sensitivity is. So were we to run lots of simulations, knowing that the measurements seem to justify that, we could give you a set of values. Not one value, but a set of values for the baryon density, vacuum energy density, Hubble constant, sigma 8. You can put in the n tilt of the power spectrum if you want that, and the two astrophysical numbers, the ionization rate for the hydrogen and helium. That would reproduce the forest, right, as we know it. I should at that point add helium absorption into the picture, and that's hard because the data is crappy for that. And now Hubble's broken; we won't ever get the better data for that. But that's what you'd like to do. We haven't done that. That's a lot of simulations. It's doable. It's now doable. We run 30 of these things, and we could do a lot more now. But this is a summary of it, and it's the same data is shown in different ways. These are priors from wherever, right? No, just common sort of values, not atypical errors. Some of these are from WMAP and so on. This is what you would derive for a single parameter if you knew everything else, all right?
The last value, the enhanced helium-2 energy rate, that comes from a temperature down.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, no, you're exactly right. So this is the one parameter where you can't actually win, right? But yeah, let me talk about the others, and I'll see if I can close that point there. So what does this mean? If you knew that the lambda was 0.73 with zero error, right, etc., and the Hubble was 71, zero error, and just go down the list, right? You ran the simulation, you've got the data I just showed you, you know the amount of absorption, you would deduce that the baryon density was 0.0417 plus or minus 0.002. That is better than we did from deuterium in 10 years of work, right? This is a 3-meter telescope. It's kind of shocking, actually. But what's behind it, of course, is the simulations and the decade worth of Fourier advance that could actually do this, right? This error is similar to the WMAP error. It's almost exactly the same, basically. And the values agree. There is no problem with that value. So now I go to the vacuum energy density.
It's similar to the WMAP error where they don't assume that everything else is known.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, we're all agreeing with each other.
No,
yeah.
They fix a megatilt to 1 to get a small error bar.
They have some prior, right?
Yeah, we got some prior.
Not as many as
not as many as
we did. Greater than 0.5 and omegatilt equal 1.
Our experiment might have cost, except for the supercomputers, very little, right? It's The vacuum energy density, you'd get 0.69 and so on, right? 78 for the Hubble, 94 for the other work on the forest also seems to get these fairly large sigma 8 things. And that area is a little complicated. I don't have much more to say about that at the moment. Or the best one to get, of course, is the hydrogen ionization, because that's probably the least well-known of these things. It can be done from, say, proximity effect, but that has almost factor of two errors. Piero's value was by counting things, and I think an excellent value, but this is basically a measurement of the effect of it. And so this is probably the best value. So we think Piero is exactly right. Hart-Madow value, we agree, right? Within one sigma there. The next thing is, how sensitive is the hydrogen absorption in the forest to that parameter, right? So this is taking the measurement error that I've got, and I think I know the amount of absorption in the forest is 12% plus or minus 1%. Right? So plus or minus 1%, that translates into these numbers. Right, so that's what it does. So it's actually quite sensitive to a whole bunch of things, right? It potentially does a very good job on sigma 8. That's competitive if you do the other things, right? So what I'm trying to say is that the correct way to deal with this is to get all the degeneracies right, so you know what the how different parameters relate to each other, and you quote a set, right? You don't quote one value, but you quote a set, and the set's usable. Or you can just quote the hydrogen ionization rate down there. Now the helium, if you made the extra heating 3.2, you get the hydrogen absorption right, but you no longer get the line width right. So that one's not good. And I think that was the.
But that doesn't really comfort your data set.
No, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So that it's kind of a nuisance parameter that we've adjusted to.
But it's like almost half of the line.
Excuse me? Which?
44%, I mean, is the main effect.
Is that right? Is that right? No, it's the other way around. So this means the mean amount of hydrogen absorption is not going to give you a good value for this, right? That's kind of what it means. Yeah, that way. And the last column says the same sort of thing. So there's the end there. So this is actually the first calibrated data set. The reason is nobody bothers. It's a lot of work, right? It's obviously fairly easy to do it. If anybody knows how to automate that, we're very interested. There's tons of data that would use that. But as I say, we've thought about it, and we believe it's very tricky, not just tricky. I can, of course, make an algorithm that exactly reproduces any simulated spectra I've got, but I don't know if that's the right spectrum, right? And so as I go at higher precision, I'm going to have a bit of a problem with that. It doesn't close. And then I think I've summarized all of these other things there. So the Sloan get much the same results, right? They go at it very differently. They've concentrated mostly in the power spectrum, and their values are completely consistent with ours, as far as I'm aware. And they have lower signal to noise, but they've got way more spectra. They have to pay careful attention to errors that I don't. I just have to show my systematic errors are less than a random, and I'm kind of done. And I think it's showing you that the forest is finally yielding the physical information that's in it, right? And that was the set of parameters that you saw at the beginning. The Sloan exactly agree with us that you need good simulations. The most recent McDowell paper from about 6 weeks ago, if you read the paper, you'll clearly see statements that they wish they had these big simulations. They were using lots of fast, simple ones, and they're off by 10%, and they have to do a lot of corrections. So this area is going to use a lot of supercomputer time because it's going to yield stuff. It's going to yield an interesting new set of data. And I think in many senses, comparable to WMAP in sensitivities, right? The data parameter connections are going to have similar sensitivities to WMAP. And feedback seems not to be a big issue at these sort of redshifts. It's below the 1%. Nobody can see any sign of it. I stop. Thank you.
Does it stick to lambda? It just deals with the fact that you impose a plot.
Well, I did impose one, so that's all I'm talking about, right? But it'll change. Well, it won't do much to the growth factors at these times, but it'll change obviously the path length. I should talk about that for a second. It's actually very interesting. And we should have known this years ago. The natural unit for observations is kilometers per second, because that's redshift, and that's what we measure. Well, we measure angstroms, and that becomes redshift, and that's kilometers per second. There's no issue with that, and it's model independent. And angle on the sky is arcseconds, all right? In a simulation, you've naturally got megaparsecs, and you've got to convert them, and that's where the lambda comes in. If that helps a little bit there. So what we do is we assume a flat universe, we change the lambda, and that's all we change. But of course, once you do that more than a little bit, the simulation no longer matches the data in some sense. So you probably want to change other things simultaneously, and you could bring it back into agreement.
So would you be able to distinguish flat universe with point theta or matter
I don't know. There are papers in literature that talk about that sort of thing, but I haven't gone back to them knowing what we know today to see whether or not they hold up to the modern data standards. Does that make sense?
It looks hard to
me. Yeah. Well, a short summary is that any old simulation with gravity will get things right to about 10%. And when you get to 1%, it gets very interesting, but it also gets very hard. So somewhere between 10 and 1%, yeah, you could indeed distinguish, and I don't know. Breaking the degeneracies, I'm not comfortable saying much about that at the moment. For instance, I'm not sure that the Sloan people have necessarily done broken degeneracy. I mean, you often take extra bits of data, and that was what we're just talking about.
What do the degeneracy contours look like relative to the CMU1?
No, we don't know that. To do that properly, you should run hundreds of these big simulations, and that was impossible last year. So it's now possible. It could now be done. We could now do that. I mean, you've got to be kind of smart about it. I mean, some of these things are analytic, right? Lambda almost is, but for instance, the Hubble constant and the baryon density, that whole sector is analytic. You can do that to four decimal figures on the back of an envelope, and the simulation agrees when you test it. So yeah, you got to find all those first, collapse the parameter space down, and so on.
But so you don't have a Fisher matrix?
No, that's quite a bit away from where we are today. I think, yeah. See, there are issues like that thermal history, right? So I run 100 simulations, right? What if I got the wrong thermal history, right? They're all trash, Or else I have to do complex shifts to, I mean, sometimes here we're running a simulation and then later on we realize, well, actually we got that parameter wrong, because we didn't know it right. And then you have to shift the whole set of results. And that just gets messy. You don't really want to do that. We did that. The Sloan guys are doing that. The Seljak paper, the McGonnell paper does that. But that approach will work, and that's what the result will be, right? The talk on this subject in a year or two's time will be the Fisher matrix, which will be passed on to the community, just as the WMAP data will be, right? Or something else. Yeah, exactly right. And that's why your stuff's very important, because the better we know the prior on the ionizing rates, the more useful.
It must be a mistake that we got it to within 7%.
You're using low resolution data. There is more information. What could you do with higher resolution data? There is more information there. You're using mean DA, mean absorption and dispersion.
Sure.
But if you could fit the line, you would have a column density distribution.
That's right.
Or you can look at pixel optical depth and distribution of data.
No, that's exactly right. Yeah. So our data set's wrong for that because signal to noise isn't high enough and so on. You can break the degeneracies is what you can do, because things like the, if I talk technically, the bias parameter for the forest, which is the ratio of what you observe, the power spectrum of the flux, to what you put in, which is the matter power spectrum, it depends on frequency, K, right, resolution. So if you've got more than one resolution, you've got a whole new data set, basically. It's another way of looking at it, right? And I got one of Tom's papers right in front. I was going to talk to him about it. And you can clearly see the effects at high resolution that are not going to show up in low resolution. Well, they'll get diluted. They won't be as obvious.
I mean, I think a lot of other groups don't have the sweet simulation that you guys have. So is there any hope to apply this simulation
actually a high resolution sample, like, you know, some sample that has been collected from LTE or so.
Sure. Well,
the data is being accumulated as we speak.
Yeah. Let me try to answer that quickly. I think that we've done the main thing at this redshift. This simulation I showed, in fact, a whole lot here, fail at higher redshifts. They're wrong, right? And if we're going to go to higher redshift, we're going to have to change them, right? I'm probably going to change them in a way that won't change these. Yeah, Hart and Madow are probably wrong, at least, right? Yeah, we don't reproduce the mean flux correctly. Way off, so, right? Yeah, I shouldn't tell you that because we're supposed to be independent. I'm saying that the subject works better if you predict what you think the number is, and I do what I think it is, and we compare them, right? I mean, I at the moment know what I'm going to do to your values to make the simulation better agree. But I think it's better if you do what you think you should do, and we see if we agree, right? I know how much you should change at what redshift and so on. But, like I said, it's the issue of prediction. It's much more exciting when you get a.
I know. I think we're already being biased. I think there are new models, and that's if we get a difference of 0 to higher than 5%, we discard.
That's right.
That because we know it would.
Yeah. That's right. No, exactly. Is it? Yeah. What? But we're not certain we're right here. No, Piero, you are correct. This is the first time we've done this sort of thing. It's not being checked, right? The values I'm showing, we believe, are more accurate than previous ones, which means there's no way to tell if they're right at this stage, right? For instance, the calculation of what should be the variation in the forest-only absorption, right, is very easy for a powerful theorist, right? It's very hard for an observer. Somebody should be able to do that in a couple of days, right? And did we get that right? You know, if we got that wrong, then that's a big clue we got some other things wrong. There's plenty to do in these areas. There's this discovery potential, of course, right? Because if we can get a simulation that exactly matches the forest using 1D data only, right, then if I now look at pairs of sight lines, right, I should have fully predicted that. Or if I look at pairs of sight lines and metals in them, now I can start to explore metals, which I could not do before I had this concordance model. I would have been miles off. We know that because our group works on Alcott-Pachinsky. And if you don't know the concordance model, that's why we went down this route and we were kind of forced into it. You can't just run a simulation and put sight lines through it because you won't agree with the 1D data. You'll be miles off. You know, so you got to get it right. So you have to do this little machine here. So one reason we're at redshift 2 is our Alcott-Pachinsky data is at redshift 2. That's why we're at that redshift. That was the long, long ago reason, but we end up kind of liking that. So, I'm trying to say it's got a good future. There's plenty of sensitivity here at the few percent level, and that's nice. You know, observers can handle that. Simulations can handle that. The simulations, I think, deep down were meant for these high precision quality measurements. They'll be excellent at that. We'll get a lot back out from doing that. I mean, so far I've shown we've got a pretty good understanding of thing, and now we can exploit it, get something back from it. And it's a big job, is my view of that. Do you agree with that?
Sure. I mean, I'm impressed by how much you trust the simulations, though.
No, I don't. I think if you carefully listen to the kind of tone I've given in the talk, I'm being a little flippant about it. First time we've done it, we're by no means, you know, we wouldn't be surprised if another group got 2 sigma different values, right? That's possible at this stage. But what we are doing is saying from an observer's point of view, this is worth doing better. I could do it better, right, and so on, right? And from a simulation point of view, think the same thing's true. Looks like it's worth doing. That's the kind of way I look at it. It's by no means finished. The tone in the Sloan papers is often we've finished the subject. Yeah, it's all done. Don't bother looking at it. Yeah. I do not agree with that.
What was the issue with the Bernardi 2 or 3?
Yeah, in detail, I don't know. But yeah, they get a very different mean amount of absorption. Calibration of some sort.
So this is a disobey at higher redshift because it's too high?
Too much absorption.
Too much absorption.
Yeah, too much absorption. Yeah.
Of course, compared to what? I mean, you don't know what the right answer is.
I've spent, over a year on this. And the Shia stuff is better. The Jupe stuff is better. No, but Jupe overlaps. Not my data.
Yeah. I agree, but the higher resolution may have a different problem on higher
resolution. May well do, but I'm just saying, as an observer, if I had to pick one or the other, I would like 95% pick Jupe stuff over Bernardi.
But on average, it's 4 as well, same?
I don't know how much data he's got there.
It's just that at redshift 4, you say that in between the lines, the spectrum recovers, we know that that's not true.
Yeah. No, you're correct. Yeah,
we know that's right. Wrong.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the errors at redshift 2, as I say, I'm getting an error in the mean absorption about 1%. That's probably about right. That's an observer statement, not a simulation statement. That error will continue about the same out to redshift 3 in a bit when you go to high-resolution spectra. But by 4, I totally agree with you. The error has exploded, no more information from this line, right? You've lost one of your main observables. And given that, it's probably not going to be as interesting, right? It goes in different directions, things like the reionization history or metals or something like that. But it won't be doing this cosmology concordance stuff, based on what we know. There's no reason why you couldn't predict the spectrum, from the red side to the blue side. But at the very least, you're going to need very well calibrated spectra because you're sensitive to a few percent in things, and those are rare. I think it's not impossible to get an automated algorithm that did it. It's just not very easy. So maybe it'll work.
Okay. Well, thanks.